It is about a relation between physical space on the one hand and then quantum theory on the other hand. And I should really say that both Lewis and me, we're not experts at all about space-time geometry or quantum gravity or other fields where you might usually want to discuss these things. So that's why I'm also kind of curious, and I would like to encourage you to comment on this and tell us what you think about it and maybe help us understand what that actually means, what we found here. Probably there are things in other fields that are related that we're not aware of. Okay, so let me start with an overview of the talk. In the beginning, I would like to tell you about the motivation of this work, which is a kind of curious observation on the geometry of quantum states and physical space. So in a nutshell, it's about the qubit being three-dimensional and Euclidean, and space also being three-dimensional and Euclidean in some way. And this is kind of remarkable. Then I'll tell you about von Weizsäcker's idea, what to make out of that, and also why I'm not so much convinced about von Weizsäcker's approach, and I think one can do more. Then I'll have to tell you about the framework in which we're working. So we talk, for example, about d-dimensional physical space. We talk about some events happening probabilistically, and this will lead us to the framework of convex state spaces or general probabilistic theories. And then later on, I'll give three information theoretic postulates, like A, B, and C. They kind of say how space and probabilities, like geometry and probabilities, how they are related. And then we'll explore the consequences of those. And so the first two of them will turn out to give you a Bloch ball, but a d-dimensional version of that. And also like a way for observers or for physicists to infer geometric information from probability measurements. And then if you take all the three postulates together, you can show that actually this gives you that the spatial dimension must be three, that you have quantum theory and unitary time evolution in the end. I also tell you about some generalization that you might want to have, but that's kind of impossible, unfortunately. And well, then in the end, I'll try to speculate about what this could actually tell us. Okay. So, well, the motivation is easily told about people in quantum information theory. I've seen this so often that I probably don't have to say this even. But the state space of a quantum n-level system, if you do not look only at the pure states, but at the mixed states, this is just a set of density matrices. So you have the self-adjoint n by n complex matrices that are positive semi-definite and thus have trace one. And in the case of two, so for a two-level system, this turns out to be particularly beautiful. So the set is very easily characterized. If you have a 2x2 density matrix, you can always write it in that form here, where you have three parameters, R1, R2, and R3. And the vector that's generated by them must have modulus Euclidean norm less than 1, so that this has actually a positive matrix. So the set of all these density matrices can be parametrized as the unit ball, which is this Bloch ball. And yeah, so for example, one pure state is at the north pole, the orthogonal state will always be the antipodal point. The pure states are the ones which are on the surface of that ball, and the maximally mixed state, 1/2, 1/2, is exactly in the center. And this is now not just an arbitrary way to parameterize its state space, but it's in a way the most natural one. So because if you take, say, two density matrices, rho and rho prime, and you want to mix them together statistically, so you toss a coin and prepare the quantum states with probability p or probability 1 minus p, then this picture, this goes to the convex combination of these Bloch vectors. So the statistical mixtures of two density matrices are actually on the straight line connecting the two density matrices. So this is why this is a very nice and natural parametrization. Actually, you can see that it's affine linear in this density matrix, which is why that works so well. So as you see, this is a three-dimensional ball, and it's Euclidean. It's really the Euclidean norm that is less than or equal to 1. And that's kind of curious because at least in the non-relativistic realm, like space also seems to be like that somehow. So how come? What can we say about something about this coincidence? First, just a little physical picture that I don't want to get too much into it, but that's kind of the motivation for all that, which is the Stern-Gerlach device or Stern-Gerlach experiment. Oh, the magnet is invisible somehow. Sorry for that, here should be a magnet. Hope you can see it. Okay. So the fact that the two-level system is basically a three-dimensional ball means that if you want to do a measurement, you can always do it with this Stern-Gerlach device if you rotate your magnetic field in the right direction. So you can basically do all noiseless measurements just by rotating this direction vector of the magnetic field, which is kind of interesting. And we'll talk about that later on a bit more. Good. Now, this is something that in quantum information theory most people know as well, but it's sometimes a misunderstanding, so let me also clarify that. So if n is larger than 3, then you don't have balls. So then state spaces are not balls anymore, but they look more complicated. For example, this paper here is quite nice by Bengtsson, Weiss, and Zukowski. They try to give a nice picture of a quantum 3-level state space, so the set of 3x3 density matrices. And this is a kind of picture that they came up with. So the set of all these density matrices is still a convex set. And you have some pure states here. And these pure states are extremal points of this convex set. But then you have some other states that are kind of on the boundary here, but are not pure, but mixed. For example, this one here. This is a mixed state, 1/2, 1/2, 0. And it could sit, I don't know, somewhere here, for example. This is definitely mixed, but it's on the boundary because if you just wiggle a bit here, you get some minus epsilon, so you get outside of state space. So this means that you have mixed states on the boundary, and this is why this cannot be a ball. It's a complicated high-dimensional convex set. So this means like the only ball that you find is a quantum state space is actually three-dimensional, which gives a bit more weight to this observation. And this was probably a motivation as well for Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker to come up with his theory of Ur-alternatives, which is quite impressive because it was in the 50s already, and he talked about the Ur-alternatives, which is nothing but a qubit. So you can say he really had the idea of the qubit 30 years before other people talked about it, which is really interesting. And he tried to kind of derive space-time from the idea of the Ur-alternatives. And here's a really just a very brief and rough overview of how he did this. So he said, well, our whole world is quantum, so we can decompose it into these qubits or Urs. So let's do that and everything, consider everything as composed of these Urs, which are somehow delocalized in space. And then we know that every Ur, like this quantum two-level system, has a symmetry group, which is a unitary group U of 2, which is like SU2 times U of 1. And then he says, well, good. Now, if every Ur has a symmetry and everything is composed of them, then this should also be a symmetry of the resulting space that we see, like of macroscopic space. And that's how he kind of argued that this S3, like the three-dimensional sphere, is a model for cosmological space, and this S1 is a model for cosmological time. But yeah, so that's really interesting. But still, you can say, so what does that really mean? So personally, I think this is not really clear what that actually means. So it's a bit vague. So you can ask, how is this decomposition into these qubits, into these Urs, actually chosen if they are delocalized, for example? And you can ask, though, why do I decompose into two-level systems and not like into ternary Ur alternatives or three-level systems, which would just give a different answer to this question? Why should that be global space-time? So that's all not so clear, I think. But still, it's interesting to see that other people before had kind of similar ideas that were motivated by this observation. Now, in recent years, I think people have learned much more why qubits are interesting. I mean, time has passed since the 50s. There are some new directions that have been taken. For example, this axiomatization of quantum theory that Lucien started 10 years ago. There's been work on qubits, on quantum systems carrying reference frames that people like Giulio and Rob Speckens have worked on. So this has been a motivation for us to look again at this problem and this idea and try to see with some new tools what we can say about this. And so the goal of the work that I'm showing you now is actually to explore a bit more rigorously mathematically what this relation between the spatial geometry and the quantum state space geometry is. So and that's how it goes. I guess a summary. So we start, we'd like to start by not assuming quantum theory, and also not assuming that space is three-dimensional, so we leave the spatial dimension arbitrary. And we consider only a very simple experimental scenario that is kind of motivated by this Stern-Gerlach experiment. Now, I really don't want to talk about silver atoms or magnets and anything like that, so I really want to have a more abstract scenario where you just have measurement devices that you can rotate. I say a bit more about that in a few minutes. Well, and then we have these three postulates that will show how probabilities and rotations are related for these devices, and this will allow us to prove that it must be three-dimensional and we must have quantum theory. All right. So here's the framework. It's basically the framework of general probabilistic theories, which some of you know and others might not know. So we just say, assume that in physics some events happen probabilistically. To make this more clear what we mean by that, we always assume or have in our mind the picture of a measurement device which measures some system that is prepared. It goes into the device and it gives us an outcome. In the following, I will only consider measurements with two outcomes, which might be spin up and spin down or something else. I will just call them yes and no. And these physical systems, which could be particles or whatever you imagine, we can imagine that they are in some state omega. And the state is then fed into a measurement device M. And now what is omega? So a state omega just tells you how to compute probabilities for the measurements that you want to do. So if you have a state, we can always compute the probability to obtain outcome yes here if you measure if you do a measurement M on the state omega. And I'll just call that M of omega. Now in this framework, also statistical mixtures are included. And similarly in quantum theory, if you have some state omega and some state phi, and you just toss a coin and prepare one of them randomly. So you prepare omega with probability p, you prepare phi with probability 1 minus p, and this is modeled just as the convex combination of the states. So p times omega plus 1 minus p times phi. If you look into Hollywood's book on statistical aspects of quantum theory, you can see a bit more in detail why this always is possible, but you can do this. If you have done that, then you want that your measurements respect this mixture, the statistical mixture, right? So this means that your measurements, if they act on such a statistical mixture, they must give you the mixture of the outcome probabilities. So measurements must be affine linear if you accept this. Now, if you take the set of all states that are possible in your theory, then this gives you just a state space, which is a set of states, which might be rather arbitrary. We've seen that we want to be able to make mixtures. So this means that the state space will be a convex set. And for physical reasons, it should also be topologically closed and bounded. And it should be finite dimensional to avoid technicalities. So that's what we assume now. And otherwise, it's a really arbitrary set. So you can come up with any kind of convex set you like and consider this as your state space. Now, the extremal points here will be called pure states. This is the same as in quantum theory. And the mixtures will be called mixed states. And here are some examples. Let's see how that works. So if you have a classical n-level system, then, well, classically, what can you do? Well, you can prepare the first or the second or the nth level, or you can toss a coin and prepare mixtures. So all you can do is prepare probability distributions. So the set of states is just a set of n outcome probability distributions. And there are n pure states, which are just ones that happen with probability 1. So this is the first pure state. This is the nth pure state. And these are actually state spaces for a classical 2, 3, and 4 level system. This is a classical bit. So there are two outcomes and they're statistical mixtures. This is a 3 level system with 3 pure states. So classically, you get a simplex as your state space. Now, quantumly, for a 2 level system.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So the mixed state, is it like the gray area or?
Yes. So these points are the pure states. And the gray area is a mixed state. Whenever you have some probability different from 0 or 1, you call it mixed, right? Because you can write it as some mixture of these three states. Yeah. A qubit quantum two-level system is a ball. The pure states are on the surface. We've just seen that. And now these three state spaces are neither classical nor quantum. They are something else. The first one is maybe not so strange. You might imagine just a qubit where you see only a projection on the xy plane. So maybe you're not able to do any measurement in z direction. And so you see only this projection of your state space. But these are really strange ones. So let's look a bit more at these two, because I would like to show you that the shape of the state space tells you a lot about the physics of these things. So let's compare the circle and the square, because this will be interesting later on. Now, if this is part of a qubit, you can imagine doing a spin measurement in x direction. You can ask, is the spin up in x direction, yes or no? And well, this will give you yes or no with certain probability. So the probability that you get yes will be called x of omega. And now for some states, like this one here, the probability will be 0. For some states, it will be 1. And here it will be 1/2, for example. If you do the analog for a square state space, you get these states that give probability 0 or 1. Now let's do a y measurement. Then these states give probability 1 that you obtain outcome spin up. These give probability 0 for outcome spin up. And similarly here. So what you say is that in the square state space, you find some state omega where both probabilities are actually 1. So you'll get spin up with certainty in x direction and spin up with certainty in y direction. And now in the circle state space, if one of them is probability 1 in x direction, then in y direction, you necessarily get 1/2. So what we found here is kind of complementarity or uncertainty of some state space, like in quantum theory. So we cannot actually have states where both measurements give the same outcome deterministically. Yeah, so just to keep in mind for later on, if you have this like a curved state space, like, or it's round, yeah, then you have some kind of uncertainty in the state space. Whereas in this case, you might not have uncertainty. Okay.
So can I ask another question?
Yeah.
So then here, what's the difference between pure and mixed?
So here, you have only these four pure states.
But like on the left.
On the here?
Yeah.
So yes, so the pure states are those on the boundary here, uh-huh. And the mixed states on in the interior.
The boundary is always pure and anything is in the middle.
Not quite. Like here, for example, like if you have this state on the square, then it's a mixture of this state up and this state down here.
Yeah.
So it's a mixed state, even though it's on the boundary.
Okay.
So it's like it's a convex set and the extremal points are the pure state.
So when P is the midpoint of a segment, it's mixed. You can find the segment where the point is the midpoint, then it's mixed.
Yeah. Okay, so one more thing. You can imagine that you do also a transformation to your state before you measure it. So what's a transformation? Well, a transformation takes a state and outputs another state. So it maps states to states. And it also must respect these probabilistic mixtures. So it must be linear. These are linear maps. So here we're only interested in reversible transformations, which are transformations that you can invert. Yeah, so you can apply the transformation and then you can undo it again if you like. And these form a group, like a compact group, might be a finite group. If you look at quantum theory, these are exactly the unitaries. So in quantum theory, these are the maps that take a density matrix and map it to U rho U dagger for some unitary matrix U. Okay, so this is about probabilities. Now what about space? So we don't need to assume a lot about space here. I'm just saying that let's really naively assume that physics takes place in these spatial dimensions. And let's avoid to talk about relativity. So we only talk about systems that are at rest with respect to the local laboratory frame. Everything happens locally and at rest for the moment. And then space looks pretty Euclidean and, well, as we assume, d-dimensional. So Euclidean means what you assume as well is that we can rotate things. So we can take a macroscopic object and can do SOD rotations with it. In particular, we can think of measurement devices and rotate them, and that's the interesting thing. Now, as we've learned, everything that you can do to a state and everything that you can do to a measurement must be linear because it must respect these probabilistic mixtures. So what if we rotate a measurement device like that, this should be some linear map that achieves it. So what this does is it gives you a linear group representation of the rotation group. So if you have some rotation in SOD, this is implemented by some reversible transformation, GR, that you can apply to your measurement. That's pretty much the same as in quantum theory. You can also, like in quantum theory, because these are just linear maps, instead of applying that to your measurement device and measuring some state, you can apply the dual transformation to your state and then apply the original device. It's like going from Schrödinger to the Heisenberg picture, which you can always do by linearity. Okay, so this is the framework that I would like to work with. I hope this has kind of become clear.
So in the Stern-Gerlach case, mm-hmm. it's only the rotations about the axis that the part is traveling along that change what you're measuring. If I want to measure spin along the axis the part is traveling on, I have to do something more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. So it's not a case that I can map over all measurements just by doing rotations of the Stern-Gerlach. Mm-hmm. Similarly with photon polarization.
Yes.
So do you have in mind some more general kind of representation of SO3 to sort of map over the whole space and states?
So the thing is, I don't really want to talk about Stern-Gerlach in particular. So I will tell you about an abstraction of that, where this problem doesn't come up. But of course, in practice, you might want to, like, you have your beam coming in, and then you can only rotate your magnet in this direction. Don't have much freedom to do it otherwise, right? But I would like to ignore these difficulties in the following and just say, assume that I could actually just take that particle inside my device, so it's at rest, and then I could actually rotate my device. So that's a bit not like it works in practice, but that's, I'll tell you in the next slide what this looks like. It's like the idealization of a Stern-Gerlach. It's not really Stern-Gerlach. I don't know if this answers your question. Okay.
I think you can always mimic the rotation on a different direction by just putting another transformation. I mean, that's what you do, for example, with polarization of photons, mm-hmm. which are equivalent to, let's say, Stern-Gerlach. Mm-hmm. So you do different rotations with polarizers and Hadamards in between. So
okay,
you can do a general.
Yeah, good point. I mean, I should say I don't want to look at polarization here because I really think you could take the particle and be at rest, which you cannot do with a photon, for example, right? But I think you're right in principle.
Well, you can think of the photon getting inside a loop, in a fiber loop in your apparatus. It's captured there, and then you do one sort of transformation inside that loop.
Oh, I see.
The fiber. I mean, you can always do that.
Okay.
So even in the Stern-Gerlach case, so long as the angle between the angle between the beam mm-hmm. and the direction you're measuring is not 90 degrees, mm-hmm. then you have some momentum in that direction, I think you're okay.
Oh, I think so as well, yeah.
Yeah, so I think you can measure almost all directions, just a subset of measure zero. You can't measure.
So. Yeah, it could be. Since my knowledge of experimental physics is poor, I just go on. And look at the abstraction. Let's see. Yeah. Okay. So I told you I give you postulates about how systems behave. And what I would like to say in a certain sense is I would like to say that there exist systems that behave like binary units of direction information. Yeah, whatever that means. I'll tell you in the next few minutes what I think that should mean. Now, this is a very long word, so let's abbreviate it by a direction bit. What do I mean by that? So this is now the idealized setup. We don't have to talk about silver atoms anymore. We just say, good, we have certain systems that in states, if I'm in some state omega, and I call these direction bits. And I can imagine that I can put them into a measurement device. And this measurement device, this particular type here, points in a certain direction. So maybe it has some symmetry, like a rotational symmetry, so that the way this thing works depends only on a vector, on a direction vector x in d dimensions. This is, could be the direction of a magnetic field, for example, or something arbitrary, something else. And then you can rotate this measurement device so that points in another direction. And you can choose which direction you want, and you can input your direction bit into these measurement devices, and you get an outcome which is either yes or no with some probability. Now, the probability to obtain outcome yes, I denote this again m of omega, but now mx of omega, because it depends on this direction x. And the direction vector, if you rotate the device, I mean, it doesn't change its length. It's just really a direction. So I parameterize these things by vectors that are in Rd and have norm 1. So mx of omega means that x is a vector of length 1. Yeah, so that's what I said. So the functioning of the device depends only on one direction vector, x. And this is the notation for resulting probability. And, well...
Sorry, can you take instead of Rd, SOD? Because that's what you do.
I'll come back to that in a few slides. This is an interesting question. Yeah. I'll answer that. For the moment, let's assume it's just a vector. Now, this could be, suppose it's just a thermometer that measures the local temperature, then rotations won't do anything. It just will be always the same. But there should be something more interesting going on, and the first postulate says that there is actually something more interesting going on. So the rotations matter in a certain sense. So first postulate, number A, says that there exists some state omega and some direction x, such that if I measure in that direction, the probability to get yes is just 1. So I get yes outcome with certainty. But now if you measure in another direction, you get probability less than 1. So this is a state where there's one direction, so that only in this direction you get a deterministic outcome. And just quickly write down, because I'm using that later on, a so
question?
Yeah.
So what happens if, for example, you have your measuring spin?
Mm-hmm.
You have a state which is a linear combination of spin up and spin down. You're saying that you can always find some direction that will give you with certainty that, that your measurement is spin up.
If it's a pure state, you're right, yeah. So what you're saying just tells us that in quantum theory, this is the case with spin measurements, for example. Right? I'm not saying this is the only state. There might be many of those. But there exists at least one state. There might be more that has this property.
So it's not for all states, omega. There is a direction.
No. Well, it's not surprising that they can rotate things in the end. It's not for all states that you find a direction with that property. I agree. Yeah. Okay. So here's a trivial system that does this. So suppose your system is just a watch, a wristwatch, which is stopped and has this pointer here, the small one, just on a fixed place. And now what the measurement does is it has a camera, it just looks at the watch, determines the relative angle between his vector and that of the watch, and then outputs yes with some probability, like relative angle divided by 180 degrees to the sixth power. Right? It's a very weird system, but you can check that it does what we want here. But you will agree that this is not really what we would like to have.
Is something special about 6?
No.
No.
Should be positive, so I want to talk about negative numbers or something. I just made it up. But it tells us that if you really want to, like a unit of direction information, we want something more. So you don't want to talk about that one because this carries a lot of extra information. This has like color and a weight, and you can classically read out all the many positions. So you can get lots of information, like different information, rather than just this yes, no information from it. So the second postulate will be a minimality postulate, which tells us that it's kind of the smallest system that has this property that we want. And here is it. So if we have two states, omega and omega prime, that have their maximal yes probability in the same direction, like both in the North Pole direction, give probability one, for example, then there must be the same states. So once we know in what direction you have to measure to get the largest probability, and you know this probability, then you know your state. So you can think of it in the following way. You can say, well, then the system carries information on this direction, x, where this maximum is taken, but it doesn't carry any further information, only that. So this is, in a sense, this gives you the smallest possible state space that you can use to transmit direction information, if you want.
So can I just understand, so the maximal yes probability in this context could be less than one, because they could be like mixed states, for example?
Yes, yes.
So just two states that obtain maximum value for that state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Since you allow these mixtures, you cannot avoid this. You will always get states that don't have probability one somewhere, but always less. Yeah. Okay. So.
Oh, and just one more question. What about like in quantum theory, the completely mixed state, which is unique? Okay, good.
So, yeah, it's unique.
Of course. So.
Okay. So, what you can show then from, okay, let me also write down this number B, just to refer to it later. So we have two states, and they have the same maximum, in the same direction. Okay. Good. So if you look at this a bit more closely, you can actually prove from these two postulates that the state space that you have, the convex state space, must be a d-dimensional ball. That's like the first step to do. And D is actually the spatial dimension of physical space. That's already interesting because that's a situation we have, actually. We have qubits, and they are three-dimensional, and space is three-dimensional. So in a way, this tells you that both should be the same numbers if they satisfy these two postulates. So how's the proof going? I just briefly want to sketch this because it tells you something interesting. Namely, the group representation theory is very important here. So the first postulate tells you that actually for every direction, you find a state where the measurement gives probability one in that direction only, and less than one in the other directions. Then you can define the maximally mixed state, which is just the group average over all states that point in a certain direction. This maximally mixed state doesn't change if you do a rotation to it. And you can define a Bloch vector afterwards. A Bloch vector is just the difference vector between a state and the maximal mixture. And then if you have two points on the sphere, like y and x, and x is rotated to y, this means that the state omega, the Bloch vector omega x, is rotated to the Bloch vector omega y. Now, group representation theory tells you that you can find an inner product on this linear space that carries your states, so that all these Bloch vectors actually have the same length, like norm 1, because they're related by a group. They're on the same group orbit. And if you look at postulate B afterwards, this minimality, which tells you that every state can be decomposed into this maximally mixed state and one of these states on the surface here. And now this actually tells you that your state is a ball. It might have another dimension than the spatial dimension, but in the end, you get a one-to-one correspondence between these directions and the pure states, and this gives you that the both must agree, actually. So the smallness of the state space comes actually from group representation theory and not directly from directions in the physical space. That's important to keep in mind. And that's Yeah, I come back to that soon. So we have found something interesting. For example, this d-dimensional ball is not a classical state space. It's a non-classical state space. And it's round, so as I showed you before, it has uncertainty and complementarity encoded. It has actually d independent, mutually complementary measurements that are like x, y, and z in, for the quantum bit. And now, if you take a rotation and you take its action on the state space, then this is always a group automorphism. And group automorphisms of the orthogonal group are always of that form. So they are all inner automorphisms, which means that for every physical direction, the corresponding Bloch vector, the two are related by some orthogonal map. So this is not automatic. You might imagine, OK, here's a physical direction. Here's the Bloch vector. They are just unrelated. They like non-linearly related. But they are related by an orthogonal map. Now that's interesting in this thought experiment here. So suppose you have some agent, Bob, here. And he lives in d-dimensional space. He's a physicist, and he wants to measure angles. For example, the angle between these two devices of vector x and y. So that's his goal. He wants to get this angle. But then, for some reason, he doesn't know how to measure angles. He just doesn't have any geometric tools to do that. So what can he do? Well, he can do probability measurements to do that. So let's assume that he doesn't have this like triangles and all the stuff that he wants to have. But he has lots of preparation and measurement devices that he finds in his lab or in nature that are just lying around that he can just try out and see what happens. So here he can, like, he finds these, he can push a button, he prepares a state. It will be a direction bit in some direction. He doesn't know what direction because he cannot measure, right? He cannot measure angles. Then he finds all these measurement devices. He knows that they do some measurement in some direction. But he has no idea in what direction that is, right? Because, again, he doesn't know how to measure angles. So what can he do? So here's a protocol how this agent can actually find relative angles just from probabilities. So what he does is he just walks around and just grabs d of these preparation devices, which prepare states omega 1 to omega d. Now, if he's not too unlucky, then these states, these Bloch vectors, will be linearly independent. Otherwise, he just has to try again in the end. Now he has these states, and now what he does is he just tries out all the different measurements that are lying around and finds d of them so that the ith measurement on the ith state gives probability close to 1. So he has his first state. And then he tries out a bunch of measurement devices, many thousands of them, until he finds one where this is close to 1, this probability. Now, if you look how the device actually acts, then this is a spin measurement. So you can write the action as an inner product between two Bloch vectors. And this allows the agent actually to compute the inner, like to determine by measurement these inner products between the Bloch vectors here and put them into one large matrix. And then you can compute a solution like S transpose S equals this matrix. And if he does that, well, then he's fine because he has found coordinates for these Bloch vectors in some orthonormal basis. And now what he does is he feeds these states into his two devices that he's interested in, observes the probabilities, and in the end he will find the vector, like the angle between the Bloch vectors, which is the same as the angle between the physical directions. So, yeah. I mean, disregarding the details of that, this should just tell you that, in a way, space, well, the geometry of state space just determines the geometry of physical space in a way. And that's a way to make that rigorous somehow. Okay, now let me come back to your question. So as I said, we've looked at devices that have the symmetry so that they are parametrized just by a vector. Now, we could more generally just have a device which does not have the symmetry, like this thing here. Like you can rotate it in three axes, and it's not just one vector that characterizes the orientation, but it's three vectors. So it's an orthogonal matrix, big X. that characterizes how it's actually oriented in space. And now you can prove, if you go through the same two postulates that we had before, but for these kind of devices now, then there is no solution. So these postulates do not have a solution for this more general situation. And we can even understand why this is the case. That's a proof. So we just do the same calculations again. We find that the state space is still a unit ball of some dimension. And now the pure states are labeled omega big X, and big X is in the orthogonal group. And they are on the surface of the ball. But now, the orthogonal group topologically is not simply connected, but the sphere is simply connected. So you cannot find a map from the one to the other. Yeah.
You have a D greater than or equal to 3 up there. Is that what you wanted?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. For D equal to 2, this is just both is the same. Like, so okay. Orientation is just the same as the direction.
Okay, but I thought 3 was, I thought you were going to distinguish 3 from 4, 5, or 6.
Yes, that will in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the next step. I still have a third postulate that I didn't tell you. Okay, good, and that's coming now. So what we like to have for physical systems is that they can interact with each other. So if I have one of these direction bits and I have another one, I would like to have that they can somehow interact by time evolution. Maybe by reversible and continuous time evolution. And that's exactly the third postulate. Which says that if I have two of them, like this is direction bit A and this is direction bit B, they have a joint state space. And then postulate says that there is a continuous one parameter group of transformations on this global state space, TTAB, T is like time, it's a real number, which is not just a product of local transformations. So it's not just a product of a transformation on A and a transformation on B. So we can have some continuous, because time is continuous, some continuous reversible time evolution, which is not just A and B evolving independently from each other. That's a possible. Okay, just quickly. Good. Now I claim that this gives us three dimensionality and quantum theory. But to show you that, I must tell you a bit like how you can actually build composite state spaces, what assumptions you use. So one assumption is, like a standard assumption is that composite state spaces always contain something that I call product states, omega A and omega B, which is just means that you prepare omega A on the first system and independently omega B on the second system. Also, it's assumed that you can do product measurements where you measure, I call them MA and B. So you measure MA on the first system and MB on the second system, and you ask, do they both give outcome yes? And the probability is then the product of the two local probabilities. So that's kind of clear that we want this. Then what we also would like to do is we would like to have a way to rotate the two systems globally. So suppose we have a rotation in SOD, and then we would like to have a unique way of specifying how we apply this to these two systems at once. These could be two particles. We just want to rotate them at the same time. Well, that's easy locally. We just saw that if you have one state, we just apply GR to it. And now if we have product states, we also kind of know what to do. We just rotate the first one and we rotate the second one independently. Now what if it's correlated state? Well, we don't know, first of all, but this rotation here should be linear. So if these product states actually span all of the space, then we know what to do, right? And this is an assumption that goes in here. So we assume that the product states actually span the composite state space. And this turns out to be true for classical probability theory, for quantum theory, for almost all other models that people have studied in this framework. And it's equivalent to something that's often called tomographic locality. It means that if you have a global state on AB, and you want to find out what state that is, then you just need to do local measurements. So global states are uniquely determined by probabilities of local measurements and of their correlations. That's an equivalent formulation. And this allows us to use the tensor product symbol, actually. So the product of two states will then actually be the tensor product of the two states, and similarly for measurements. And the global rotation is just the tensor product of the two rotations. Okay. So now that's the interesting part. So the claim is if you have postulates A, B, and C, then we must have dimension 3.
You also have tomographic locality in here as well? Or?
Yeah, that's an assumption that's put in.
That's a background assumption.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's how I want to motivate it, because if you have two geometric degrees of freedom, you want to rotate them at the same time.
Okay.
You somehow must know how to do that.
Okay. But like strictly speaking, it's an extra assumption.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Okay. And it doesn't work without that assumption.
So can you repeat the motivation?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I got.
Mm-hmm. So suppose you didn't have that, then you would have more degrees of freedom in your state space. In the global state space, yes. And now suppose you know how to rotate on one side, you know how to rotate on the other side, and you want to do both independently. But then there's no unique way to do that.
When you say you know, you really mean that you know also how to do it when you do it globally.
Yes.
When you say that you know a transformation.
Well, you know,
there is a unique way to do it.
You assume you just know it locally.
What you know means.
So all you know is how to do a rotation on B, and then you also know how to do a rotation on A.
You mean how to do it locally? On the
locally, yes. Yes.
But in this sense, it seems tautological to me. Because if I only know what this transformation does locally, mm-hmm. I want this knowledge to be sufficient, then the local states should
span
yes.
the state space. It's, yes.
By knowing, you mean knowing what it does locally, this is what you're saying.
Yeah, this
knowing local behavior is enough.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. That's the motivation for this assumption.
But physically, I think that knowing would mean also knowing what the transformation does.
That's not what I mean. It's the local rotations determine the global ones, let's say it like that.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay, good. So the claim now is, actually it's a theorem that from postulates A, B, and C, it follows that the dimension must be 3. So how does it work? So here's a proof idea. Actually, the proof is written up already. It's on the archive. And it's work with Lewis and then also with David Perez Garcia and Remigius Oguziak. And so here's a proof sketch. So we have, if we look at the global system, we have two types of transformations. We have this time evolution, TTAB. And then we can also do the local rotations. And we can just look at the Lie group that's generated by both of them and call that GAB. Then we can look at the corresponding Lie algebra and look at the Lie algebra element X. Now, suppose we start with a product state, so omega X on the first system, omega Y on the second system. Then we apply the transformation E to the TX, and then we do a product measurement. And this should always give a valid probability between 0 and 1. And so here is a circuit model that shows what we do here. We prepare these states, we apply these transformation, we do these product measurements. But actually for t equal to 0, this is the identity. And so these two things, this gives probability 1 and this also gives probability 1. So we get 1, the value 1 here, the maximum value for t equal to 0. But now if it's less than 1 for all other times, it must be a maximum. So the derivative must be 0, the second derivative must be less than 0. Yeah. So if you take the derivative of that, you end up with this equality, which has the generator x in it. The second derivative gives you x squared. So we get two constraints on these Lie algebra elements x. And actually you get a bunch of these, like lots of them, if we consider several situations like this. And we can try to evaluate them. So let's see what they give us. Well, I cannot go through the details, unfortunately, now. But it turns out that if the dimension is not 3, then the only generators that satisfies all of these constraints are generators which are of the form xa plus xb. So these are non-interacting generators. And they generate product transformations. So these guys just generate local rotations. So why, you can ask, why is 3 so special? And if you look in the proof that there's one particular part of it where you can see what's special about 3. So let's look at d larger than or equal to 3 for the moment. Then if you want to evaluate these things, you have to compute lots of integrals like this. So this is a twirling integral over the rotation group of d minus 1, where you do a rotation on the first system, and you do nothing on the second system, and you have sandwiched some element in between. And now, if this is a valid generator, then the result is also a valid generator. But now if you look at this integral, and you look at Schur's lemma and all this machinery to evaluate this, and this is very different depending on whether this group here is abelian or not. And if it's abelian, you get a very different behavior. But now it's, when do rotations commute? Well, only in 2 dimensions. So if SOD, if d minus 1 is 2, then, or d is 3, then this is very special. So this kind of tells you why dimension 3 is, well, special in some sense. Yeah. Okay. So what if we have dimension 3? The claim is that we get quantum theory. So if we have these postulates, it follows that the state space of 2-direction bits is actually 2-qubit quantum state space. So it's a set of 4×4 density matrices. And time evolution is given by a 1-parameter group of unitaries. So rho gets mapped to U of T rho, U of T dagger. And to see that, that's also published in this other paper in a different context. So we know that we have dimension 3. We can just go backwards. So we have our 3-dimensional ball. Let's just embed it in the complex matrices, like for a qubit as we know it. So let's take the vector and write it as a 2×2 density matrix. So this means we embed our state space into the linear space, the real linear space, actually, of the self-adjoint 2×2 complex matrices. And now we know that the global state space will be a subset of the tensor product space, but the tensor product of these two 2×2 matrices is a 4×4 self-adjoint matrix. We just don't know which of these matrices are all actual states. So we have to look at these constraints again and at the generators. And now it turns out that there are actually some elements which are not just sums of local generators that survive in the end. But these axes, they are still very special. If you look at them, then they generate unitary transformations. So if you exponentiate one of these generators applied to a density matrix, you get a conjugation by unitary. So you recover unitaries. And by postulate C, we know that at least one of them must be an entangling unitary. We also know that we have all the local unitaries because these are the rotations. And so if you take them all together, they generate the group of all unitaries. But then these generate all quantum states. So we have all 4-level quantum states. So could there be more? Well, if there would be more, you can easily show that this would lead to negative probabilities for some measurements. So there cannot be more states. And we get exactly quantum theory on 2 qubits. Yeah. Okay. So conclusions. So what I showed you was kind of an attempt to clarify the relationship between spatial geometry and the qubit in a bit more mathematical rigor somehow. You can say these are really old ideas. Von Weizsäcker had them already, but then we have some new techniques now, like these general probabilistic theories. And this is just a very simple situation that we considered. So we started with d spatial dimensions, not assuming quantum theory. I gave you 3 information theoretic postulates on the relation between spatial geometry and probability, and then showed you that this determines dimension 3 in quantum theory on 2 of these bits. So the question is, what does that actually mean? We don't know. Yeah, we have no idea. Might just be a coincidence. Still, I mean, some things are there that we can tell, I think. Like one conclusion is like this very neat behavior of the Stern-Gerlach device and all its nice details that you might put into these postulates. This is only possible in three spatial dimensions, which is kind of an interesting physical conclusion somehow. Then I would also say that you can say, well, it's just interesting to consider generalizations of quantum theory in the context of fundamental physics. And you might say, well, what about generalizations? You could look at, so, well, let me say it another way. So everything here was local and addressed. You might want to consider also relativistic situations and see what happens there. This would be, for example, like an interesting generalization. Yeah, and then there's a speculation, that's why I personally like this thing, is maybe it tells us that space or space-time in quantum theory both like have a common origin, which is of information theoretic nature. So it's not like you quantize space somehow, but it's like both, you derive both from some other thing that we don't know yet. Maybe that's the message of this result. Okay, let me thank as well some people for discussions, in particular Lucien Hardy and Lee Smolin for encouraging this kind of research. And here's a reading list. So for those who would like to start reading about these general probabilistic theories, there's a paper by John Barrett. So here's a result that rules out all dimensions different from 3. This is that D equals 3 implies quantum theory. And as I told you, the results in this talk are not yet published, but hopefully this will come soon. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
We have time for some questions.
What happens if you consider a Stern-Gerlach experiment with a spin 1 particle? You have 3 possibilities.
Yeah. This is a very good question. I think this is a very natural generalization. Where you here, you would say, let's not have a device with 2 outcomes, but with 3 outcomes, and consider the analogs of this postulate. And you might expect to find spin 1 particles then, like quantum 3 level systems. I would, at least, that should be natural. Yeah. But I haven't tried this.
I guess I mean a related question. A lot of the aspects of what you did was very reminiscent of angular momentum theory.
Mm-hmm.
Are there concrete connections there? I mean, I guess there must be. Have you explored?
Well, some of them are obvious. For example, you have these rotations, and you can look at their generators, and they correspond to angular momentum operators. There's an analog of this also in D dimensions here. But I haven't looked at, like, physically, if there are closer connections.
I guess I meant more some of your arguments ruling out dimensions. Can you make arguments based on, say, angular momentum rather than on postulates like yours?
Maybe yeah. That's not possible. Interesting question. I really don't know the answer. Could be.
So you started by imagining that you had a direction bit. Compares just one bit of information about direction in a d-dimensional space. I was just wondering if you did something similar, say, a one bit encoding of time information. So, in the context of quantum reference frames, you can look at something that encodes the direction, but another standard example is something that encodes time, timing information.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just wondering if you tried to apply similar techniques to that, and you found that the dimension, the number of temporal dimensions, for example, has to be 1, and that would suggest that you're on the right track. Whereas if you found that none of this generalized to those other degrees of freedom, then maybe it would be more evidence in favor of this just being some sort of coincidence.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, do you have any idea how applying these techniques to other degrees of freedom, is it likely to work? Is it clear that it won't work?
So I haven't thought a lot about that. It's a really interesting question. So I don't know the answer right now. That's just something that I found interesting. If you look at these these state spaces, like a Ball state space. These are the normalized states, right, that I showed you. And if you look at the unnormalized states, then you get always, what you get is a kind of cone. So these are the normalized states. And now a set of unnormalized states looks like that. Now this is actually a Lorentz cone in a really formal sense. And you might ask, that, well, maybe this is somehow related to, you know, 3+1 dimensional space-time. And there have been some speculations on this, I think. And maybe you want to interpret this normalization as like a density of events, how often something happens over time. And you might want to start over with that. But this is all very vague so far, and I don't have any good idea how to do this.
Any other question?
Okay. Completely separate question. At some point, you showed a scheme for, you know, you had the Bob who didn't know anything about geometry. Mm-hmm. And then you had this nice scheme where he takes a bunch of preparation procedures, a bunch of measurement procedures, and ends up characterizing them. Mm-hmm. So what struck me about that is it's an example of bootstrap tomography. So usually we do tomography and preparations knowing the measurements. Mm-hmm. We do tomography and measurements knowing the preparations. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, a hard problem, but you had the promise that these were pure preparations and maximally informed of measurements.
Well, if not, you would see that. Because you want, so you try out measurements until you get, yes, probability close to one. Once you have that, you know it's maximally informative. There's just no more for a ball. You don't have many other possibilities. It wouldn't work for other state spaces, I think. It only works for a ball and for a qubit. I think that's crucial here.
So you're saying even if they were mixed states and non-maximally informative measurements, you could still do tomography on the two simultaneously as long as you had enough measurements so that you could be sure to find one.
Well,
that would...
So... This is really very inefficient. So suppose you have infinite time, you're very patient.
Yeah.
So if you take a mixed state and then you try trillions of measurement devices and you never find probability one for even one of them, then you would just discard it and grab another one. And you would just do that until you find one where you actually find something which is close to probability one. Then you know it must be a pure state and it must be maximally informative measurement. I mean, it depends a bit on the details about what you actually know about these measurements and so on. But.
So I guess the scheme is not easily generalized in case I just have 13 measurements and 17 preparations and I want to do tomography.
I don't think so, no. At least I haven't thought about that.
Any other questions?
Just a second. Is self-duality implicit anywhere in the background?
No.
Or are the first two assumptions somehow, could they be seen as equivalent in some sense? I'm wondering if you can see what self-development is.
Okay. As this first answer, no, self-duality isn't built in. Also, saturatedness is not built in, for example. You can have noisy measurements and so on. So you're saying this is like duals to each other somehow because this is about measurements and this is about states. Oh, that's interesting. So I have to think about that. I don't know. I mean, the example that I show you with the watch tells you that they are not equivalent because the watch satisfied the first one, but not the second one. So, but they could be related in a dual way somehow. That's interesting.
Was another question?
Just a quick question about the Bob with the protocol. Who doesn't know how to measure the angles. That only works if Bob knows D.
Oh, Bob. I think Bob has to know D.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if he doesn't know D, then he can't do that, right?
Yes, yes. Also, he has to know that there's one more parameter in the theory which basically tells you how noisy your best spin measurements are. They could be inherently noisy. And he kind of has to know that as well. So he has to know these two parameters of the theory in the background to actually do that. Yeah.
Any other questions? I do have a question. So what is special about the maximum probability in the second quadrant? Because when you say that two states that have the same directional information should be the same, mm-hmm. I would expect the same probability distribution for every direction measured. But here, somehow you are saying that it is enough to check for that particular measurement that gives the maximum probability.
Yes.
How do you interpret this?
So, the way I... Okay, I mean, that's always a question how to motivate postulates, right? You can question if they are meaningful or not and so on, it's hard to say. But, so what I imagine in that situation is, suppose the direction is the North Pole, and I have one state which gives probability 1 for the North Pole. Now another state also gives probability 1 for the North Pole, omega and omega prime, right? So if these are different states, and then I can just use that choice between the two to encode more information. So it's like Alice wants to send this North Pole direction information to Bob, but then Alice can also choose if she wants omega or omega prime, and
yeah,
put this.
They could differ, for instance, for the probability of direction east as opposed to west. There would be another direction in which they give different information.
Yes. Yes.
So one is like, I don't know.
And this would, but this would be potential information that Bob can decide to read out instead, mm-hmm. like additional one.
Yeah, sure.
Right, but this
because
kind of says
you have
that
many directions in which you can measure.
Yes, yes. I mean, yeah. Mm.
So this would be still be directional.
Yes, in a way it would be, sure, but. Yeah.
So could you do the same things without this maximum? Like for every x, instead of maximum number x?
If for every x, the probability is the same? I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I think
because
it's
you would need to check more conditions.
Yes. I think you can have really... Couldn't you even have spin 1 particles or higher spin particles then? I think you could. Because
in some sense, you would need to motivate this maximum. I think more than it is now.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
Is there any other question? Yeah.
Could you remind me how you arrived on the fact that the group you were integrating over was SLD minus 1?
Well, in a way that's somewhat a technicality.
Mm. So is this technicality dependent on the fact that you have yes-no question? Or?
Mm. So you mean this one, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Now this is more of a Lie algebra thing. So it's just, there's a theorem that tells you if a generator in the Lie algebra, and then you sandwich it between map and its inverse. This is another generator of the Lie algebra. And then you can do linear combinations. You even get a new generator. So it's just, if this is a generator, this is also a generator. But this one looks easier, usually. This has more zeros in the representation. And that's why we use that, and that way showed that it violates some of these constraints. It's really a technical step in the proof, and nothing specially related to having a bit or something like this.
Okay, so this wouldn't change if you increase.
You would have basically the stabilizer group of your symmetry group that you integrate over, which is SOD in this case, but would be another group in for another state space.
Yeah, but so you derive the dimensionality of space with the fact that you want SO to. Will the stabilizer then still have some Hartmann structure that would get dimension from? Or?
I think I didn't get this. Can you say?
So the fact that you get D equals 3 by requiring that this is a DM.
Mm-hmm.
Would it still be something that could be a DM in other cases?
Well, not in this framework, because we just seen that you have SOD. You can generalize this a bit and look at subgroups of SOD that still allow you to rotate in any direction, for example, and you get the same result. But just in very different physical situations where you're not interested in rotations at all, you might not get the same result, of course. So this depends on the framework, on the background assumptions we have.
But the spirit of this is that in all dimensions higher than three, mm-hmm. if you ask what's the subgroup under which a direction is invariant, mm-hmm. it's not abelian. And only when you get to D is equal to three is the answer.
Yes. Yes.
So you can say that's one. That's sort of the kernel of what's special about D is equal to three.
Right.
The abelianness of the subgroup that preserves directions.
Yeah.
So I have a closing comment on the remark before. Perhaps the way to say the same thing that you're saying would be to say that you're interested in direction pointers more than in directional information in general. So perhaps this condition being the condition for a pointer to carry no more information than the direction in which it points.
Ah, yes, yes.
As opposed to general directional information.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Yeah. Yeah, that's the idea, right? The particle kind of points in some direction, but you don't really know which one.
Yes.
But it only does that and nothing else.
So it's really like something more specific than directional information, but really the point.
Yes. Yes.
There are no more questions. Let's thank Marcus again.